From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Against the backdrop of President Bush's State of the Union address this week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee busied itself repudiating the president's chief initiative. The senators voted for a resolution denouncing the so-called surge of 21,000 troops as a last-ditch effort to stem the violent chaos in Iraq. And the press was all over the controversy.
On Iraq, a key Senate committee votes to oppose sending more troops.
Brian, it was a deeply emotional debate in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, echoing the turmoil across this nation.
Today, the Senate took the first step in officially rejecting the principle of sending more troops to Iraq,
saying Bush's plan to increase troops in Iraq is not in the national interest.
But while the debate was raging inside the Beltway, according to Washington Post online columnist and military affairs expert William Arkin, the actual surge was underway and virtually ignored by the media.
Here's the fact. The United States has deployed a brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division forward to Baghdad. That is part of the surge. The United States has extended the tours of a number of Army and Marine Corps units in Baghdad. That's part of the surge. And the United States has deployed the first of two new Marine Corps battalions in western Iraq from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. That's part of the surge. And hardly any of this has been reported in the mainstream news media.
Does secrecy have something to do with it? Media typically refrain from reporting troop movements for fear of giving the enemy too much information.
Well, in this particular case, I don't think we have this kind of troop movement secrecy problem. It has been the case that the Defense Department and the Army and the Marine Corps have been somewhat modest in announcing these deployments. But I get the impression, Bob, that it's more the case that the news media's mind is elsewhere.
However, we've been, you know, in this war for 4 years now, and there has not been a huge amount of coverage to date about troop movements and deployments. Why should NBC News, for instance, want to take pictures of a new battalion hitting the ground in Baghdad?
The President of the United States has announced a change in strategy. Key to that change is an augmentation, a reinforcement of U.S. forces. And it's part of the story, period.
Obviously, I defer to you because of your extremely broad expertise on these matters. I mean, down to the very smallest units. But is it possible that you are such a military wonk that the story has not caught up to your granular understanding? Because really nothing has happened yet for anybody to report.
Well, if you're going to give me credit for being such a wonk, then you should also ask me what my intuition is. And my intuition is we are never going to see a significant difference as a result of these 21,500 additional troops being sent to Iraq, because this surge, this image that we have of reinforcement of U.S. forces, of Marines storming the beach and paratroopers falling from the skies, is never going to occur. We are dribbling in our forces, splitting them up amongst many different places, keeping tired troops in Iraq who are ready to come home. In fact, we are hostage to what the Iraqis will do, and that was always the plan. And the surge, to some degree, is merely a political smokescreen for the Bush administration to buy more time.
Dude, you buried the lead. The story then, if I'm hearing you correctly, is not that the news media as a group have taken their eye off the ball of the movements on the ground, but they've failed to detect that the vaunted surge is not a surge at all. Is that it?
Well, look, we have to get through the mountain of Valentines, which have been written about General Petraeus, the new commander in Iraq. We'd have to get through the mountain of words that have come out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and other congressional committees to be able to determine that they actually care about this question. So, yes, you know, you might be right. I might have buried the lead myself in questioning the surge, but there are so many people out there, Bob, who are writing about this from opinion. And what I'm trying to do is say, hey, let's actually look at what's going on the ground and ask ourselves the questions, first of all, whether or not these additional troops are there, what they're doing, and whether they're going to have a difference. The military itself wants to dampen expectations about the surge, that they're not putting out the big press releases that say the 82nd Airborne has arrived in Baghdad and the 3rd of the 6th Marines has arrived in Al Anbar. And why is that the case? Maybe it's the case that the military itself doesn't want to increase those expectations that this change is going to make any difference, because doing so would then make them responsible for the ultimate failure.
All right, Bill. As always, a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Bill Arkin is a columnist for Washington Post Online and is a fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University.
This State of the Union address was President Bush's sixth officially, but it was the first before a Congress where his party wasn't in control. This calls for a different type of leadership, a mode where if you rush into the breach, you can't be assured that a screaming horde is right on your tail. To diagnose some of the subtleties of this speech is former presidential speechwriter Michael Waldman. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
My pleasure.
And you were the former chief speechwriter for Bill Clinton, right?
Yes, I was, and I worked on four of these State of the Union speeches, and I still get night sweats thinking about it.
As a member, a one-time member of a presidential team, how does the White House know what the reaction is? Do they wait for the talking heads on TV to give it a little spin? How do you know?
Well, it's a big media moment, and there are many audiences. The first audience is, in fact, the members of Congress, the politicians in the room, and you really do care how they react. The second audience is the wider circle of, say, the political class, the pundits, who help determine whether people think a president is politically dead or alive, politically relevant or irrelevant. And so that's the group of people who were watching and getting ready to chatter on Tuesday night. And then the final audience is the public. With Clinton, it was really interesting. There were very different reactions from each of these audiences. Clinton would give these very long State of the Union speeches, as you know. They would go on and on. And as soon as he was done, all the TV talking heads would go on the air and say, that was a disaster. He was terrible. He went on and on. He's irrelevant. He's finished. And then the polls would come in, and it turned out the voters loved them. Approval ratings would always go up. His popularity would go up the longer the speech was.
This was where the idea of Clinton talking over the media came into play.
That's exactly right. And part of it, I do think, is that even now, the State of the Union is one of the only times where the television networks will show public affairs programming. Ask yourself, the rest of the year, how much primetime real estate is given over to discussion of public issues? And it's hard to imagine that it would match the 2 hours on State of the Union night. The public really likes hearing directly from its leaders.
And the other thing is the political reporters have heard speeches, if not this speech, speeches hundreds of times, and members of the public hear maybe one speech a year.
That's right. But what's interesting, of course, is, as I said, in Clinton's case, the pundits would sneer and the public would cheer. Here, the public has rejected and reacted viscerally against President Bush's policy on Iraq. His speech a few weeks ago, which was supposed to set out the policy and rally the public, drove people away. So that when the speech came around, I don't think there was a whole heck of a lot he was going to be able to do to change that dynamic, and he didn't really try to. I was watching at home, and I was most interested, to be perfectly honest, in the reaction shots of the senators, all the people who think they're running for president, and then in hearing the response afterwards and the interviews with the presidential candidates. Bush, in some respects, seemed like a distant echo, except for the fact that he's still president and he's still commander of the troops and he's escalating the war.
Let me ask you one question about the reaction of the senators and the congressmen, everyone in the room. There, it seems to me to be an element of kabuki, or actually it's a lot like the Roman Catholic Mass, a lot of up, down, up, down. I think that if there were no cameras there, you know, barely a buttock would leave the leather. But then, you know, you do have this spectacle of people standing up. And I was kind of surprised that a guy named Paul Glastris, who's a respected editor of the Washington Monthly, he said that if you time the duration of the standing ovations, he bets that it was a shorter length of time for standing ovations than any State of the Union he ever saw. I don't know if he's right or not, but does that matter?
When Lyndon Johnson gave his speeches before Congress, he used to hop into his presidential limo and ask Jack Valenti how many times the audience applauded and how long the applause was. Now it is quite ritualized, as you say, and everything gets applauded some. There is an element of, as you said, kabuki. It is the case that the response from the Congress, including the Republicans in Congress, for this speech was as tepid as I have ever seen. You have had other presidents lose control of Congress.
Your president did.
Bill Clinton did in 1994. Ronald Reagan did in 1986. Dwight Eisenhower did in 1958. And Lyndon Johnson lost a lot of seats in 1966 in the middle of the Vietnam War. Usually, not always, but usually, presidents respond to that rebuke from the voters by tacking toward the center, by tacking toward the Congress. And on domestic issues, I think Bush did that. But on the issue that was, in effect, the subject of the most significant politics and the most significant public interest in this election, Iraq, the president did not tack toward the Congress or toward the public. He turned away. And that's quite unusual. It's not what Ronald Reagan did. It's not what Bill Clinton did. And it's a lot more like what Lyndon Johnson did when he said, well, we're going to continue to pursue the Vietnam War and the Great Society at the same time. The outcome on the ground in Iraq will determine the political outcome.
Michael Waldman, former chief speechwriter for Bill Clinton. He's the director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU Law School. Thanks very much, Michael.
My pleasure.
Coming up, media influence peddling in the Middle East.
This is On the Media from NPR.
If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast, and we were one of the first national radio shows to offer a podcast. The thing is, it's free for you, but it costs us money. So would you consider sending our station, WNYC, a little extra to help pay for it? Just go to WNYC.org and let them know that our podcast matters to you.
This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In Lebanon this week, a general strike called by the radical political party Hezbollah paralyzed Beirut, then mutated into violence. Clashes between Hezbollah's Shiite faithful and those loyal to the government as of Friday had left many injured and four dead. The confrontation once again raised fears of renewed civil war in Lebanon and raised questions as to Hezbollah's nature. Is it a legitimate opposition party, a paramilitary militia, a parallel government delivering social services to the poor, or a terrorist group subservient to the revolutionary Shiite theocracy in Iran? Or, perhaps, all of the above. Wherever the truth lies, Hezbollah is certainly one other thing, a primary source of information through its Al-Manar TV station, for millions of Lebanese. The question is, can the propaganda arm of Islamic revolutionaries be regarded in any way as a legitimate news organization? Reporter Kelly McEvers got a rare look inside a broadcast operation regarded by the U.S. State Department as a cheerleader for terror.
Al-Manar went on the air in 1991. It reported on battles between Hezbollah and the Israeli army, which had occupied southern Lebanon for nearly 10 years. By 2000, Israel unilaterally pulled out of Lebanon. Hezbollah took much of the credit, and Al-Manar grew in popularity. The station began broadcasting 24 hours a day, via satellite, to millions of viewers around the world. Al-Manar built a new million-dollar headquarters here in the southern suburbs of Beirut.
We're standing on the side of the hole in the ground that used to be Al-Manar. The hole's about four stories deep. It's now just a cesspool of rainwater, debris. There's a lot of CDs or DVDs down there in the water. It's almost an entire block of complete destruction.
Al-Manar was bombed by the Israeli army last summer during the most recent war between Israel and Hezbollah. Minutes after the bombing, the station was back on air from a secret location. The attack raised questions from press freedom groups. Is it okay for an army to target a media outlet? Is Al-Manar itself really a terrorist entity?
In terms of general news coverage, they do a pretty fair job.
That's Judith Palmer Harik. She's an American professor here who speaks Arabic. For much of the day, Harik says, Al-Manar looks like CNN or Fox News. Headlines, graphics, embedded reporters, opinionated commentators. But unlike the Arab world's best-known TV station, Al Jazeera, Al-Manar also airs blatant propaganda. An animation showing the leaders of Israel and the U.S. as dominoes falling to the ground. Clips glorifying Hezbollah soldiers, who later died fighting Israel. The soldiers' faces transform into doves flying toward heaven. And in the past, Al-Manar has aired virulently anti-Semitic programs, including a so-called history series showing a rabbi adding the blood of a Christian child to his matzah dough. It's this kind of content that in 2004 got Al-Manar banned in much of Europe. Europe's laws allow the prohibition of speech based solely on its content. The U.S. government has different standards. U.S. officials say they banned Al-Manar not because of content, but because it incites people to commit violence and fundraises and recruits for Hezbollah. Still, moderate viewers here say they see little of that these days. In this cafe in central Beirut, men and women sit on couches, smoking and drinking wine and beer. The women are uncovered. Opposition protests rage outside. The cafe crowd is waiting for the next round of news, a speech by Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Al-Manar is projected, larger than life, on the cafe wall. We don't always agree with Al-Manar, the women at my table tell me, but we have to watch it. All of Lebanon's TV stations, more than 10 major outlets, are affiliated with one political or religious group or another. Al-Manar, they say, is one part of the larger story. Ever since Al-Manar was bombed, no one knows exactly how they broadcast the news. It took me 3 weeks to get an interview there. We were told to drive to a street not far from the old Manar headquarters. Then we were met by a guard who led us to another guard and another.
I actually have a small camera, too. I can give it a personal.
This third guard took us up to the second floor of an apartment building.
Thank you.
Employees say news stories are produced here, but broadcast from somewhere else.
My name is Dhia Abu Ta'am. I am 27 years old. I worked here in Al-Manar since the year 2000.
Dhia Abu Ta'am is a well-known Al-Manar correspondent. He trained at the BBC in London. He reported from the front lines during the war last summer.
I'm law graduated, but I hate to work as a lawyer. So I found journalism is more connected to public opinion and to people, ordinary people. And that's very interesting to me.
Abu Ta'am says blocking access to Al-Manar in the U.S. and Europe means the West is missing an important element of the Arab story.
Take our stories, take our life from us, and hear us, hear the other point of view, make a comparison between what you see and what you hear, and then we will have your conclusion. Maybe it is right, maybe it is not, but you are now responsible for your conclusion.
American professor Judith Palmer-Harik has drawn her conclusions. She wrote a book on what she says is Hezbollah's transformation from a terrorist group to a political party. She says most people in the Arab world see Al-Manar and Hezbollah as a legitimate resistance movement against Israel, even after the Israelis left Lebanon in 2000 and the two sides spent years trading attacks over Lebanon's southern border. But the West still points to Hezbollah suicide attacks against the U.S. Embassy and Marine barracks here in 1983 and 1984. Those attacks killed nearly 400 American and French employees.
Which is very difficult for Americans to forget.
Judith Palmer-Harik.
I mean, after all, Americans saw their young Marines and so on coming home in boxes. Mm-hmm. And so the constant drumming on that point keeps that very, very fresh in people's mind.
Since then, though, Harik says, it has not been confirmed that Hezbollah has led suicide bombings against civilians. These days, she says, they target the Israeli military.
What they tried to do very much was distance themselves from that term, terrorist. And that meant that they would gain no grounds anywhere by attacking innocent Israeli civilians. I do believe that they also would like to have some credit from the West for not acting like Al-Qaeda.
Despite this distinction between violence against civilians and violence against soldiers, there is still a culture of martyrdom on Al-Manar. And that leads critics in the U.S. to say Al-Manar is promoting terrorism.
A martyr is not a new phenomenon for Islam or the Arab world.
Nabil Dejani teaches communications at the American University of Beirut. He says the debate about Al-Manar boils down to a clash of perceptions between the West and the Arab world. What is terrorism? What is martyrdom? Each side has its own answer.
When a soldier throws himself on a bomb to save his colleagues in the United States, you give them medals. The same thing here. We call them martyrs. A martyr is a person who sacrifices himself or herself for the sake of the safety of his or her group. This is not new. Now, you tell me Al-Manar encourages this? Yes. I mean, not only Al-Manar. This is something that is acceptable all over the Arab world.
For On the Media, I'm Kelly McEvers.
The more sophisticated the audience, the harder the messengers have to work. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, describes itself as America's leading pro-Israel lobby. And one successful form of that lobbying is the junkets they've provided for journalists for the past 2 years. They supply the itinerary, set up interviews and tours of the country, and they hope you, the journalists, provide favorable coverage for them. Most big newspapers forbid junkets, but in some news organizations, they're treated on a case-by-case basis. Recently, two editors from the online magazine Slate, Emily Bazelon and David Plotz, took the Israel trip on AIPAC's dime. Emily joins us now. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Well, why'd you let them pay for it?
Because they offered, essentially. And also because we are an opinion magazine, so the opinion analysis we do has our ideas and our thoughts in it in a different way from traditional beat reporting. And we also make very sure to disclose the trips that we go on.
Most newspapers, most magazines don't let their reporters go on junkets. Do you think that there's any logic to that?
Oh, sure there is. I mean, look, there's no way that this isn't a problematic thing to do, which isn't to say that we shouldn't have done it. I mean, I don't regret that I went. But I completely see the argument that it's troubling and creates these ambiguities and creates questions about our objectivity in covering the region. My own sense is that the problematic part of this has to do with things that are fairly specific to Israel. But we went to a lot of briefings with important Israeli officials from the government, from the army, etc. And I do think that we actually got a pretty varied picture of Israeli politics from different parts of the Israeli political spectrum. But what we didn't get was a regional picture, or a picture that did very much to fill in the thinking of the Palestinians. That's a problem. I mean, certainly I can't give myself an out by saying, hey, I'm really willing to go on a Palestinian junket because, you know, for the most part, I imagine they don't have the resources to be sending people on those junkets. So that's kind of a fake defense.
Recently, you wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine about post-abortion syndrome. Well, what if the Right to Life Foundation or Planned Parenthood said, you know, we'll drive you around in a van and we'll pay for your expenses and, you know, you'll sleep at a hotel and that way you'll get to talk to all the right people in our movements?
Well, obviously, I wouldn't have done the story that way. I mean, that's not how to go about reporting a story in a way that gets you what you need for any kind of reporting, where you're trying to present characters and you're trying to tell a story from lots of different points of view and be fair. That's why I wasn't working on a magazine story in Israel about the AIPAC briefings that I was going to.
So the difference is what you intend for the output to be?
Yeah, I think that is a big difference. I mean, look, I think all of these things are partial disinfectants. So I don't want to seem like I'm completely excusing myself or erasing the troubling aspect of these sorts of trips. But I do think it is different to go in a kind of, you know, background briefing way, which is really what David and I were doing, as opposed to going and reporting a story and only seeing what someone, you know, with a particular agenda wants you to see in the course of reporting that story.
You said disclosure would be necessary. How much, how often, every time you write about Israel, when does the disclosure end and how far should it go?
Particularly now that we've discussed all this, I think I'll be erring on the side of disclosure for a while. On the other hand, I don't think that if in 5 years I write a story about a case going through the Israeli court system, I don't think that I'm going to feel like I need to disclose that. But in the next year or so, or anything that directly pertains to something that I do feel like I learned on the junket, yes, I need to disclose it. And I should err on the side of being conservative because, you know, people can decide for themselves whether the junket is connected to what I'm saying in the piece, but they can only decide that if I let them know that I went.
All right. Emily Bazelon, senior editor for Slate. Thanks very much for your time, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
For the Bush administration, the socialist revolution proclaimed by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has made him the hemisphere's public enemy number two, right behind Fidel Castro. Chavez's radical rhetoric, anti-Bush invective, and increasingly authoritarian behavior have won him the suspicion of the American media as well. As he began his third term this month, editorials in the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times condemned his plans to nationalize huge private companies and mainly to not renew the license of the nation's most popular TV station, RCTV. Chavez's former communications minister has referred to the move as the leading edge of the information hegemony of the state, and RCTV says it has been denied due process. But to Larry Burns of the Liberal Council on Hemispheric Affairs, the underlying facts betray anti-Chavez editorializing as one-sided and simplistic.
RCTV is arguably the most scabrous example of yellow journalism in Latin America. It's an advocacy outfit, and it was one of the major plotters of a coup against Chavez back in April of 2002. This station engaged in trick photography and all sorts of scandalous behavior in order to advance that coup.
Does not the principle of free speech, even of, you know, sort of obnoxious critics, trump the history of RCTV's behavior? Is Chavez not setting a very bad precedent by silencing his most vocal critic?
This is a situation where RCTV uniquely was shouting out the word fire in a crowded theater. 95% of the media in Venezuela is controlled by the anti-Chavistas, and they have their knives out for Chavez. So talking about constitutional guarantees, you may be talking to the wrong bunch.
Last month, Chavez was reelected in a landslide with 63% of the vote in an election with the highest voter turnout in Venezuelan history. Isn't that ample evidence that RCTV and anyone else in the right-wing media represent no great threat to his government?
Well, perhaps at this moment, no. But if you are using lies, distortions, prevarications, at some point, your influence may prevail.
I want to ask you about what I referred to in the introduction, and that's the media coverage in the United States about Chavez's so-called Bolivarian Revolution. It's pretty close to being unanimous in denouncing Chavez's tactics, if not necessarily his goals. These editorial boards are not populated by know-nothings. In your view, they've all gone wrong. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, it was said of the New York Times that the New York Times will do everything for Latin America except visit it. It happens that most of the journalists, the correspondents, give measured and fair and balanced treatment. But I do think that these editorials are simply scurrilous. It's basically an issue probably more of style than substance. I mean, Chavez is the kind of fellow that you don't find at Eton. Bad instincts for public relations, bizarre antics. But this is Chavez's playful style that has nothing to do with the quality of his thinking and the proposals that he's made. He is not a cruel, heartless man. He is not a Pinochet. He's anything but a Pinochet.
You know, I don't think anybody in those editorial boards is worried that he's a Pinochet. I think they're worried that he's a Castro, and that the next shoe to drop will be a widespread attack on human rights, imprisoning of political prisoners, and whatever follows in the authoritarian slide down the slippery slope.
There's your point. That's the point, because that's what they've got against Chavez. And if you look at the language used, it's always that Venezuela is becoming, or the Chavez government will soon be. But the fact is that today, Venezuela is none of those things. It's important to realize, Bob, what's at stake in this whole Chavez business. Venezuela has always been a nominal democracy, a faux democracy, not a real democracy. And in fact, the oil wealth that started coming to Venezuela after the end of World War II, nothing ever went to the poor majority of the country. Today, Venezuela is not only a formal democracy, a constitutional democracy, but it also is a real democracy in that people have the right to more than just starved. They also have the right to access to an education, to medical help, and so forth. And that is why Chavez's support is actually increasing, much to the chagrin of the United States, which has come up with a new theory, which is free and fair elections aren't enough. It must be the quality of democracy we're talking about. They never talked about that before.
Larry, thank you very much for joining us.
Bob, it's been a pleasure.
Larry Burns is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a liberal think tank in Washington, D.C. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Mike Pesca. In 1958, Business Week assured its readers that, quote, with over 50 foreign cars already on sale here, the Japanese auto industry isn't likely to carve out a big slice of the U.S. market. Whoops! There's some joy in recognizing when the supposed business experts get it so wrong. The point is that opinion-making business writers are reactive, not predictive. Turns out pop culture is even more reactive than the business rags. As a result, movies and TV shows wind up being an excellent contrary indicator to where the market is going. George Manis noticed this trend in the January issue of Money Magazine. George, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So what are your data points, as I think they say, on Wall Street?
The classic data point is the movie Wall Street, which they started production on in early 1987. Just in time for the market to crash in October 1987.
So after the movie came out following the stock market crash, did anyone at that point put two and two together, or did it take a couple more things for a guy like you to notice, wait a minute, there might be a trend here?
Well, I have to say I didn't really think too much of it myself until 2000, when all of a sudden you had two TV shows going on the air, one called The Street, the other called Bull, which were all about young and sexy people working on Wall Street. And that struck me as a contrary indicator.
There are a couple famous things I think that people on Wall Street say. By the time it gets to X, we know the trend has crested.
Well, you mentioned Business Week. A classic cover that they had was in August 1979, The Death of Equities. It basically speculated that the era of Wall Street was over, and that was exactly the worst time to agree with the cover of Business Week and get all your money out of stocks and put it into something else.
And after 1979 was something that's come to be known as the go-go 80s, the exact period that Oliver Stone looked at and said, oh my God, we got to do a Wall Street movie.
Right. I looked up the statistics. The S&P for the decade prior to that story rose about 0.5% annually. 10 years after that article came out, annual price appreciation, 12%.
And so you not only have to wonder why Business Week was predicting the future would be bleak, but what took them 9 years to say? I mean, if they had written the story in 1974 saying get out of equities, at least for 5 years, they would have been right.
I think it's the fear of every reporter that you're calling the top or you're calling the bottom in the wrong way. That at the moment you say it's over, it's actually just begun.
Another famous stock market type movie, I think it was actually a commodities movie, was Trading Places with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Does that fit into the trend?
I think it does. Two characters in that movie are the Duke brothers, and they're loosely based on the Hunt brothers, who in real life around 1980 tried to corner the silver market. And the price of silver went up huge amounts, and then it collapsed and they went bankrupt. But the interesting thing, when Trading Places came out in 1983, if you looked at that and you thought, maybe I could, you know, try and make some money in commodities. Well, I tried researching this. I can't get you prices for the commodity that they traded in that movie, which was frozen concentrated orange juice. But I did look at silver prices. And if you had invested in silver in 1983, you would have had a very unhappy 20 years.
So far we've been talking about Wall Street, but when pop culture takes on other parts of American money society, how does it do?
Well, not so well. One thing I noticed also was that in the summer of 2005, within almost days of each other, you had two shows going on to cable TV, two reality shows. One was called Flip This House. The other one was called Flip That House. And summer of 2005 was a very dangerous time to start flipping houses.
Do you think I should try to investigate what business-related movies Paramount has in the pipeline and short that sector?
I think people at hedge funds should be sweating because the guy who created the TV series Entourage about Hollywood star and his buddies announced that he was going to be making another series, which was about a guy who runs a hedge fund and his buddies.
Now, sometimes the phrase smart money, the people who invest the smart money in Wall Street, see something. Maybe it's someone who would represent dumb money being interested in investing. And the smart money says, uh-oh, if this guy's into it, I've got something to worry about. In your case, you're saying if Hollywood's into it, maybe the rest of us have something to worry about. But there's, I think, a famous anecdote with Joe Kennedy concerning this phenomenon.
Yeah, the famous anecdote, semi-apocryphal, is that he got out of the market in 1929 before the crash. And what prompted him to get out of the market was that his shoeshine boy was trying to give him stock tips. And he thought to himself, if everybody in the whole world thinks that it's no problem to make money out of the stock market, something terrible is going to happen.
And so maybe the shoeshine boy of the 20s is the TV producer of the aughts.
Sounds like a reasonable conclusion.
Reasonable enough. George Manis is senior writer for Money Magazine. Thanks very much, George.
Thank you.
This week, in reaction to the sale and format change of Washington, D.C.'s only commercial classical music station, NPR affiliate WETA dropped much of its news and information programming and re-embraced the largely classical format it had gradually cut back on and finally ditched 2 years ago. This isn't exactly a trend. For a decade around the country, public radio stations have been dumping classical, blues, bluegrass, and jazz in favor of news, which generates bigger audiences and bigger revenues. But raising more money has also raised the hackles of music devotees and raised a sort of public radio conundrum. Does serving the public mean giving the majority of listeners what they want, or does it mean serving the underserved? Thus the question in Chicago, where to greet 2007, WBEZ dropped its last jazz music program. Jazz writer John McDonough reports.
This is Coleman Hawkins' famous Body and Soul, but it's possible on the radio that few of Coleman Hawkins' listeners would linger very long over Ornette Coleman and the abstract onslaughts of his endangered species. It's all jazz, in different languages, for different audiences. Diversity, people like to call it, but diversity is often more easily celebrated in principle than it is coped with in reality, as any radio station manager understands who has faced the prickly temperament of the jazz fan. When Chicago Public Radio broke the news last spring that it would be dropping music from its programming, it seemed to fall like a body blow on many jazz fans and certainly on the Chicago jazz establishment. The Chicago jazz establishment believes the music will lose an important place at the media table and in the city's cultural life without a strong radio voice. Its loss, they say, would leave a gap in the profile jazz has enjoyed in the city going back to Dave Garraway and Daddy O'Daly in the 1950s. But here's the embarrassing little irony. I've been a jazz fan since I was 11, yet I've almost never listened to jazz on the radio. And I'm not the only one. If you're impolite enough to ask members of the jazz establishment whether they listen to it, you might be surprised by what you hear.
I don't listen to the radio much.
Lauren Deutsch, executive director of the Jazz Institute.
Why would you even bother if you had an enormous CD collection and record collection like I'm sure you do and most of us do?
I asked my friend and Downbeat editor Jason Koransky.
No, I don't listen to jazz on WBEZ. I mean, sometimes when I'm in the car, actually, primarily listen to talk radio or CDs. I have a CD player and I have a 6-CD changer, and I bring stuff to and from the office.
And former Jazz Institute president Penny Tyler.
Now, I gave up on BEZ before we moved 4 years ago to the South. And the reason I gave up is because I thought their programming was horrible.
Why would so many of those who protest the loss of jazz the most not listen to it when it's on the air? They say the programming, and that's a good reason, but maybe not the only reason. Some suspect that a bit of a turf contest may also be at work. On the one side, the entitlement of Chicago Public Radio to program independently. On the other, the cultural prestige and expertise of the Chicago jazz establishment and the Jazz Institute in particular. Howard Reich, who has covered the Chicago music scene for many years, sees two themes at work.
One is the jazz establishment, such as it is, does grieve for what's happening at WBEZ. At the same time, they have been complaining for a long time to me and to others that they find that programming inferior. And it's implicit in that point of view that they feel they could do it better. The other thing you can't separate, as my view is that you can't separate from all this, is self-interest. They want to control as much of the agenda of what people hear as possible, whether presenting music, broadcasting, or whatever. All these people care about the music and care about themselves and their power as well. You know, there's an old saying, competition is fierce when the stakes are low.
And the stakes in all this may be lower than anybody has imagined. This is because it's not the politics of culture that's driving events, it's the technology. Jazz and blues fans typically have their own digital music collections. Like millions, they have been empowered by the memory chip, the internet, and the satellite to program their own listening. The issue isn't jazz on the radio. The issue is radio's long-term future as an alternative music platform of any kind. To get an authoritative view of this matter, I assembled a truly expert panel. My 17-year-old son and several randomly selected friends. Brant, where does radio fit into your life these days?
It doesn't fit in anywhere, because when you're listening to the radio, you don't really get to choose what music you listen to.
Well, I get a lot of my music from Brant. Lending me CDs and
my iPod. Yeah, I don't really listen to radio at all. And I listen to my music from the internet.
This may not exactly be a scientific survey, but it should make us step back a bit and see all this in a little wider context. Controversies over music formats are nothing new to public radio, but these shifts were not driven by Philistine station managers, and music was not replaced by ideological wrestlers like Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity. They were driven, stations say, by listeners. And the replacements were largely the kind of news and information programs that listeners could not provide for themselves and that have brought NPR both awards and a growing listener base. That was the conclusion of David Giovannone. He is the former head of audience research analysis, which has provided the numbers that have helped move many public radio stations away from institutional support and toward a, quote, listener-supported model. Giovannone declines interviews these days, but 2 years ago on this show, he explained the sequence of events that lay behind this trend.
The threat of diminished federal funding has in the past motivated public radio stations to become more financially self-sufficient. It means that they're going to take a hard look at their program schedules, and they're going to determine whether a program is really serving the public, really serving the missions that they have set out for it.
By most measures, Chicago Public Radio has done both through a kind of dual format: news and information by day, music by night. If listener-supported public radio is defined by the network's two tent poles, as NPR likes to call them, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, the numbers suggest that supporting those listeners means building on that base. It doesn't mean formulas either. If there is a formula behind Prairie Home Companion, Car Talk, This American Life, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I don't see it. A common sensibility, maybe, not a formula. So what of public radio's duty to serve the underserved? Again, David Giovannone.
There is a vast underserved audience in America for intelligent, high-quality, civil, civically responsible news and information programming. I guess every station has to ask itself, what constitutes a more valued and valuable public service? Providing a listener something he or she cannot get anywhere else, or something he or she can get somewhere else?
If such niche-friendly technologies as the iPod and satellite radio are replacing traditional radio as the dominant mass music platform, then no audience will be underserved. Meanwhile, it would seem that jazz and blues are not doing all that badly in Chicago these days. Joe Siegel's Jazz Showcase is celebrating 60 years of more or less continuous operation and is now in the capable hands of his son. The House of Blues has become a nationwide franchise. Both Symphony Center and Ravinia offer regular jazz programs. The city has two world-class repertory jazz orchestras up and running. And the Jazz Institute is constantly busy planning special events, such as the recent 28th annual Chicago Jazz Festival. As for the young, jazz is deeply rooted in the academic music programs of New Trier and other high schools across Chicago and northern Indiana. Who is underserved by radio? In a complicated world, recorded music is cheap and available. Smart and civil discourse on public policy and culture is what's rare.
John McDonough is a jazz writer. He produced this piece for WBEZ's own 848.
And now, after about an hour of calling to the carpet all media members who would prevaricate, equivocate, or sleep in a bed bought by AIPAC, it comes time to praise one of journalism's famous liars. Ryszard Kapuscinski was a citizen of communist Poland who documented tin pot dictators and their downtrodden subjects to great effect. His masterpieces include Shah of Shahs about the late Shah of Iran, The Emperor revealing the inner Haile Selassie, and The Shadow of the Sun about Africa. His books worked on three levels. Each was a document of what Kapuscinski said he was documenting, and backhandedly a document of the Polish people's oppression. Kapuscinski allowed Poles to contemplate their own situation via one degree of separation. The third element was nonfiction as fable or totem or grand allegory. So this one Soviet customs inspector is not just that Soviet inspector, but the face of all malignant authoritarian bureaucracy. The London Times literary supplement has a thorough rundown of Kapuscinski's inaccuracies, not the least of which is that it seems impossible for the people he quotes to have talked in the compelling manner in which they were quoted. Now, I don't think that Jake LaMotta's fights really look like operas, but I'm glad I saw Raging Bull. And I'm certain that a Spanish bull never contorted itself in exactly that way, but I'm still bowled over by Picasso's Guernica. So in the search for reality as opposed to facts, consider Kapuscinski's words about real violence against the truth. He wrote, "First you destroy those who create values. Then you destroy those who know what those values are, and who also know that those destroyed before were in fact the creators of values. But real barbarism begins when no one can any longer judge or know that what he does is barbaric." I'm glad to have read that. Richard Kapuscinski, the man Germany's Der Spiegel dubbed the greatest reporter in the world, died on Wednesday.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Mike Volo, and Jamie York, who also helped out on the audio controls. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Michael McLaughlin and Alicia Rebensdorf. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katia Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Brooke Gladstone is our managing editor. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter at that address. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Mike Pesker.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.